This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A huge scientific paper published by James Hansen and a group of international scientists contains dire warnings about how climate change will hit us. Perhaps none is more astounding than a prediction of superstorms this century greater than anything seen in human times. I don't have the scientific training to say this Hansen-led paper is right about superstorms or when they will come. In fact, it's hard to imagine storms we've never experienced, things not even perhaps described in ancient legends. But if Hansen is right, what would they look like? We can get help on that from one of the world's premier experts on violent weather. That would be Dr. Jeff Masters, the meteorologist who has flown into the eye of hurricanes, chased storms, he provides weather forecasts, and he writes regularly for the Weather Underground. Jeff, thank you for joining us again on Radio EcoShock.
Sure, Alex. Happy to be here.
Well, why don't we start here? What is the strongest storm recorded with modern instruments, say in the last 100 years?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because back in the early 1960s, there was a typhoon in the Pacific called Nancy where they thought it had 215 mile per hour sustained winds. But that was taken with some very primitive sort of hurricane hunter measuring equipment. I mean, they didn't have modern GPS or inertial navigation, and that was basically just an estimate that was not deemed very reliable. So we thought for a long time that, you know, really there's never been a tropical cyclone worldwide that's had 200 mile per hour winds. But that changed last year. Back in October, we had a hurricane off the Pacific coast of Mexico, a hurricane named Patricia, that was measured by the hurricane hunters to have winds of 215 miles per hour. That's not a gust, that's sustained. Those are the winds you encounter in a high-end EF5 tornado, so absolutely devastating sort of winds. Fortunately, that hurricane weakened before it made landfall as a Category 4 storm with 150 mile-an-hour winds.
And do we know of great storms in earlier centuries, even if we don't have the instruments?
You know, we do. There are a lot of records of hurricanes going back to colonial times, and in particular, there's a hurricane called the Great Hurricane, which occurred during the American Revolutionary War back in 1780. Now, the Great Hurricane was one of the Cape Verde-type storms that come off the coast of Africa and then impact the Lesser Antilles Islands. And in October of 1780, when it moved ashore over Barbados, the winds of that hurricane were so strong that it leveled every tree on the island, destroyed every structure on the island, destroyed the forts, took the heavy two-ton cannons and threw them hundreds of feet away from the forts. And not only did it fell all the trees, but it took the bark off the trees, which is a phenomenon we've never, ever seen in any other tropical cyclone in history, but we do see in EF5 tornadoes, those type of tornadoes with 200 mile per hour winds. So the theory is that the Great Hurricane of 1780 may have been one of these freak storms that, you know, one in 1,000 year type of storms that did have EF5 tornado winds in it.
All right, now getting to the Hansen paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms, my understanding of that, and I'm pretty limited, is a shift in ocean currents in the North Atlantic brought on by ever faster melting on Greenland will create conditions that could lead to giant storms. Is that what you get from it?
Sure. I mean, what you're seeing is that the ocean temperatures in particular are going to increase because of not only global warming, but also a shift in the ocean currents. And in fact, we can maybe see a little bit of a beginning of that right now in the North Atlantic. Most of the North Atlantic is hotter than usual. In fact, the ocean temperatures worldwide have been at record or near record levels over the past year due to, you know, global warming and an ongoing El Nino event. But if you look in the North Atlantic by Iceland, there's this unusual cool spot. In fact, it's near record cold ocean temperatures are observed there. And the thought is that maybe that's due to the fact that this ocean current shift is starting to begin. The Gulf Stream current is carrying less warm water to the north than it used to, which causes a little bit of a cool water spot to develop up there. And since less warm water is being transported up there, that means there's more warm water further south in the Atlantic to pile up and cause warmer ocean conditions. So, yeah, I mean, we expect the oceans to warm over the coming century. And just a 2 or 3 degree increase in the warmth of oceans, that's enough to potentially drive superstorms. And in fact, Hurricane Patricia last year that formed off the coast of Mexico, that took advantage of the warmest ocean waters ever recorded in that portion of the ocean. So that helped fuel its rise to 215-mile-per-hour winds.
So is it fair to say that the mechanics of storm creation described in the paper, if they develop, would agree with what we know from meteorology today?
Yeah, theory supports the idea that if you crank up the thermostat, you're going to crank up the intensity of hurricanes. They're heat engines that extract heat energy from the ocean and convert it to the mechanical energy of their winds. You provide more heat in, and you're going to get stronger winds coming out. And it's very interesting, in fact, if you actually crank up the thermostat way high to, say, 120 degrees at the surface, which is ridiculous as far as something we're not going to see in the next century or two due to global warming. But if you can somehow get the thermostat that high, you can get what are called hypercanes, which are kind of off-the-scale sort of hurricanes that have wind speeds over 500 miles per hour, central pressures down to 700 millibars, which is like only 70% of atmospheric pressure. And these storms go way to the top of the stratosphere. And we wouldn't want to see one of these storms because it can basically rearrange the entire climate system, cause destruction of the global ozone layer, and throw enough moisture high in the atmosphere that it'll block out the sun and cause kind of a volcanic winter scenario. So the models, they're very clear. You provide more energy to the system, you're going to get stronger storms.
And Jeff, one of our scientific guests talked about baroclinicity, and I didn't really know what it means. What does that mean in meteorology?
Yeah, there's two main ways that storms get energy. One is through the energy of the ocean waters, like hurricanes do. And what they do is they take water vapor off of the ocean, and the water vapor holds what we call latent heat, which means the heat that was required to convert it to vapor form. It maintains that energy, and when the water condenses, or when the vapor condenses into water, it releases that energy and powers the storm. Now, there's another source of energy for storms called baroclinicity, and all that means it's the difference between cold air and warm air, basically, or cold, dense air and warm, moist air. And what happens is that if you've got cold, dense air up high in the atmosphere and it sinks and is replaced by warm, moist air, which is less dense near the surface, then that's a release of potential energy. You've got basically an object falling, and as it falls, it releases its energy and helps power the storm. And that's the energy source that blizzards use to get going, and the normal sort of low-pressure systems that, march every few days across the mid-latitudes.
Okay, the other impact raised by Hansen et al., in fact, part of their proof, is a pattern of towering waves descending on the Caribbean from these storms, and it's partly dependent on the length of the ocean, or fetch, as the mariners say. Have you heard anything about larger-than-normal waves in the age of climate change?
It's tough. We don't have very good wave observations going back very far, but there is some thought that, yes, wave heights are increasing in some portions of some of the oceans, and it would stand to make sense. I mean, if you've got more heat energy available, I mean, that's potentially more energy to drive stronger winds and make bigger waves. So, yeah, we could potentially have bigger waves because of climate change.
I often wondered if there's any physical limit to how high waves could be. I don't really know.
Well, if you've got a 500-mile-per-hour wind, you're probably going to be able to get 200-foot-high waves. I mean, we've seen 100-foot-high waves in the oceans in huge hurricane-force storms. But, yeah, if you crank up the wind speed, I don't see any reason to have even bigger waves than that.
The idea of black swans, where things that were thought to be impossible turn out to really exist, has become fairly popular now. But the American scientist Kerry Emanuel is worried about gray swans. Can you tell us about that, Jeff Masters?
A black swan is an event that's totally unexpected that you wouldn't think could occur based on historical records or physical understanding. But a gray swan is an event that hasn't occurred in historical times. But if you look at the physics of how the atmosphere behaves, then you think that, yeah, you know, something like this is possible. And one of these storms I think we've already had in the past is this great hurricane of 1780, 200-mile-per-hour winds. It was able to debark trees. No other storm's been able to do that in recorded history. And if we look at the physics of how the atmosphere behaves, these sorts of storms can be anticipated now because we have the physical understanding. We know how the climate's changing. And Dr. Emanuel's paper thought that a type of storm like the Great Hurricane of 1780, which maybe occurs only once every 1,000 years, can probably start occurring even more frequently than that with climate change, maybe by the end of the century, between one in every 400 years, or maybe even one in 60 years, depending on which climate model you're using. So I don't like those odds very good. I mean, yeah, a one in 100-year event doesn't sound very probable, but if you integrate over a 30-year period, then, you know, you keep rolling the dice, a 1% chance every year adds up, and then you have a 26% chance of a 1 in 100-year event happening. So basically, his gray swan paper is saying a hurricane like the Great Hurricane of 1780, you know, we're going to start seeing those by the end of the century. They're going to be, you know, once every 60 or 100 years on average, they're going to start popping up, whereas before you'd only expect one every 1,000 years.
And MIT seems to suggest that, with based on this Emanuel paper, that these storms could pop up in places we haven't expected, maybe even in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to think, but yeah, the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, those have the hottest ocean temperatures of any bodies of water on the planet, and they are potentially going to get some pretty incredible storms. Those hot ocean temperatures are going to get even hotter with climate change. And yeah, we could see a Category 4 storm forming and hitting Dubai maybe and causing unprecedented havoc with the oil and gas industry.
That would change prices at the pump as well.
Well, you know, we need to get over onto solar and wind as soon as possible for a lot of reasons, and that's one. I mean, the whole infrastructure for the oil and gas industry is highly vulnerable to storms. And it already has been disrupted by a number of storms in the past. I'm thinking Hurricane Katrina caused a big disruption to the Gulf of Mexico oil and gas industry. And certainly the Middle East is prone to disruptions as well. There have been an increasing number of very strong storms in the Arabian Sea in recent years. In fact, we had two of them hit the country of Yemen last year, and that was an unprecedented occurrence, two Category 3 or stronger storms. So, yeah, this sort of thing is something to think about when we're planning our energy infrastructure.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, meteorologist and storm expert, Dr. Jeff Masters. Let's move to the southern hemisphere, Jeff. We've seen awful, deadly tropical cyclones already there this century. It's hard to imagine they could get worse, but could they?
You know, it's very interesting and a little worrisome. When you look at the global database for strong tropical cyclones, which is the catch-all term that we use to describe hurricanes and typhoons and what they simply call tropical cyclones in the southern hemisphere, we haven't ever seen a storm as strong as we had this year back in February. Tropical Cyclone Winston, 185-mile-per-hour winds hit Fiji as a Category 5 storm, devastating that island. Its most expensive natural disaster in history. So, yeah, the southern hemisphere had its strongest tropical cyclone in history this year. And over in the Indian Ocean, the southern Indian Ocean had its strongest tropical cyclone in history this year as well. Back in April, a storm called Fantala, 175-mile-per-hour winds. So in the span of just 8 months, we've seen the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the South Indian Ocean. That was Fantala, the strongest ever recorded in the South Pacific. That was Winston, 185-mile-per-hour winds, and the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the northern hemisphere, or the entire globe, actually, and that was Hurricane Patricia, with its 215-mile-per-hour winds back in October. So, you know, you look at that and you say, wow, I mean, if that isn't a warning shot over our bow, then what is? Maybe hearteningly, if you look at the longer-term statistics going back to 1990, which is the beginning of the good satellite record globally, we really can't say we see an increase in these most powerful of storms. I mean, the database isn't very long, though, and not very good. So the jury's out right now whether we're actually starting to see these changes. Certainly, climate models are expecting to see them. We expect the strongest storms to get stronger, but it's going to be a matter of decades probably before we can draw the line and connect the dots and say, okay, it's happening.
You know, in a recent program, we heard from a leader of the Carteret Islands. That's a chain in Papua New Guinea, which is being washed over by the sea to the point where they may become the first permanent climate refugees. If Hansen and his team are right, islands in different parts of the world may become uninhabitable in the next few decades, they're saying. What do you think?
Yeah, certainly sea level rise is already nibbling away at a number of islands. There's an island off the coast of Louisiana that is going to have to move, and they're in the process of trying to find the money to do it. A couple islands off the coast of Alaska, Kivalina, looks like they're going to have to move because of erosion problems due to rising seas. And that's going to continue to increase in coming decades. There's going to be, you know, a lot of trouble maintaining the defenses against the rising sea. And we're just simply going to have to abandon some areas because it's just not going to be cost-effective anymore to keep on putting up these barriers and replenishing beaches and so on. It's got to stop at some point. We've got to draw the line and say, okay, it's time to retreat.
Yes, and after every big cyclone or hurricane, politicians immediately promise, we will rebuild. They say that even in the lowest parts of Louisiana after Katrina or the most exposed parts of the East Coast after Sandy. I wonder when they'll start to say, we will relocate.
You know, it's written into the law. The part of the law for FEMA called the Stafford Act says that when we lose a chunk of land due to a storm surge, we have to put all the infrastructure back on that land. And there's a part of Alabama called Dauphin Island, which is off the coast. It's a barrier island. The western end of that island has been basically destroyed four or five times by hurricanes in the past 20 years, most recently in Hurricane Katrina. And the entire end of the island was washed away and moved, closer to the coast by, you know, several hundred yards. And what the Army Corps had to do by law is go and dredge the sucker, put it back where it was, fill in the island, and put the streets and all the power lines and the sewers back there, because that's what the law said they had to do. And guess what? We paid for it. And there are several other places that are that way, too, barrier islands that are getting washed away more frequently in storm surges. And right now, the way the law is written is we got to keep on doing something that probably doesn't make sense. I mean, we've got to retreat from some of these barrier islands and take our time to put our resources where it makes more sense, defend parts of the coast that are worth defending, where they're more heavily populated and not so vulnerable.
I hear a law that needs to be changed. Now, Jeff, I picture a situation where storms and storm surges wreck major cities time after time, to the point where we can no longer afford to rebuild, a kind of death by a thousand nasty weather events. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, there have been cities in the past that have been abandoned due to multiple hurricane strikes. Indianola, I think is how you pronounce it, a coastal city in Texas, got hit by a number of, I think, two different storm surges over a period of a few decades, and they basically abandoned the town. And that may be coming. I mean, certainly New Orleans is at risk. After Katrina, okay, they rebuilt the defenses. They put in $14 billion of new infrastructure. But if we get a Category 4 or 5 storm hitting New Orleans head-on, sort of a 1 in 200-year storm, then those defenses are not equipped to withstand that. And we may end up abandoning New Orleans in that case. I mean, the city will get flooded. The below-sea-level bowl will fill with water. And the people may just decide they don't want to come back. So we'll see. I mean, sea level rise, if Hansen is right, could be many meters by the end of the century, in which case we're going to start seeing not just one major city, but several probably have those sorts of reckoning, days of reckoning. The insurance industry is going to pull out, people are going to move, and we'll end up retreating.
Yes, and we didn't say the word Miami. Well, look, weather in the southern U.S. seems so strange lately. We've seen flooding and strings of tornadoes. Is that just part of life there, or do you think there's something unusual going on?
We've certainly seen that heavy downpours, the upper 1% of the spectrum, are increasing, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. And certainly the downpours in the south this past year are part of that trend. Now, they're also due to the fact we had an El Nino event, in fact, one of the strongest, if not the strongest on record. And when you get that sort of naturally occurring event, it changes storm tracks so that you get more heavy rain-bearing storms moving over the southern U.S. So, yeah, partially natural, partially climate change. We are seeing an increase in the heaviest rain events, and what we saw this past winter was part of that trend.
As we wrap up, I'd like to get your thoughts on the Hansen-led paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. Did you form a general impression of the storm predictions in there?
Hansen tends to be at the upper end of the dire scenario sort of scientific ideas of what are out there. If you look at some of the literature by other climate scientists, they don't see such a dire scenario happening. But universally, I hear these more cautious-sounding climate scientists say, you know, Hansen could be right. You know, he's at the upper end, but the science and the theory, the modeling, all says is that, yeah, it could happen this way. And we got to take into account not only the most probable outcome, but the upper end sort of outcome, the outliers, because outliers do happen. And one thing we do know from past experience is surprises do happen. In fact, surprises are expected. We can't pigeonhole everything that's going to happen due to climate change because there's just too many variables. The climate's too chaotic and not well enough understood. We're going to get surprises, and some high-end surprises are more likely, unfortunately, than the low-end surprises, I think. We're going to get some off-scale disasters that we never saw coming, black swans. And, well, Hansen's giving us a gray swan sort of scenario here. I mean, we can anticipate some of this through theory and modeling.
I totally agree with what you've just said. Now, I haven't seen a Jeff Masters book about storms. Have you considered it?
I have a book, a fiction book I'm working on, which presents a sort of worst-case scenario, or plausible, not even worst-case, but how things could be in 20 or 30 years, or maybe even today if we get a very bad weather year. I mean, it's not a very big stretch of the imagination to think that we could get a flooding event like wiped out the Mississippi River levee system in 1927, combined with a Category 5 hurricane maybe making landfall, and other worldwide extreme weather events, droughts in China, flooding in Europe, causing a crash to the global agricultural system, causing worldwide chaos, basically. So, yeah, that's my novel. I'm thinking of toning it down, maybe, because I don't want it to be, you know, apocalyptic. I want to have some hope. And there is hope in this whole scenario. I mean, people are very creative and very resourceful. And, you know, we have some of the answers we need to keep a disastrous future from happening, like, you know, could if we keep on going business as usual. So that's what I'm working on. I don't know if I'll ever finish it. I've been working on it 5 years already, and it just seems I haven't had the time to really put into it to get it whipped into shape just because there's so much crazy weather to talk about on my blog all the time.
Well, that's the problem I have doing this show. I think I'm catching up, and then so many jaw-dropping things happen that you can't cover it all. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with meteorologist Jeff Masters. He's ridden government research planes into the eye of a hurricane, and no doubt he's driven some back roads looking for twisters. And now Jeff writes about big weather developments in the blog, The Weather Underground, at wonderground.com. And what else do you do, Jeff? Do you provide weather forecasting services?
Personally, I don't do that anymore. I mean, are you talking about my company or myself?
I'd like to know about your company.
We provide a webpage that has, just for free, basically weather information for the world. You type in a location and get a forecast. We also have a network of personal weather stations. These are backyard sorts of weather stations that are over 200,000, I think, now. So we have just an unprecedented granularity to our weather that you can get. So not just forecasts, you can get these observations from personal weather stations all over the world. In fact, we generate weather forecasts for those weather stations, too. We also have a huge community that's very involved in participating in observing the weather and talking about it. My blog comments frequently run to several thousand per day. This is kind of an online forum where people talk about the weather. We have 1.9 million user-uploaded photos of weather that people have uploaded to share. Anybody who wants to can start their own blog to talk about the weather. We've got several hundred bloggers who write regularly about the weather on our website. And we've got a huge network of weather webcams as well. So it's just a giant hotbed of everything weather on our website. And I kind of anchor it by giving my daily commentary on what's going on in the world. And my main passion is for hurricanes, so this time of year I start getting cranked up to talk about them. But during the rest of the year, and I'll talk about tornadoes and tornado season and winter storm season.
And that's all at wonderground.com. Thank you so much, Jeff Masters, for your time and for your passion about all this.
All right, Alex, you're welcome.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As Jeff Masters says, this paper by James Hansen et al. Is looking at extremes. Unfortunately, while the extreme case may not happen, we may very well get faster and higher sea level rise, accompanied by superstorms, as Hansen says. A number of influential scientists do not yet agree with the claims launched in this paper. It isn't settled, but it is unsettling. If you search the net or look at publicly available chains of reviewer comments, it appears Hansen is at the bleeding edge and not the core of the current climate research community. I invited some scientists critical of this paper to speak on Radio EcoShock. For example, Dr. Michael Mann, who has appeared on the show before, bowed out due to a load of academic work he has right at this time. I contacted Dr. Kevin Trenberth. He's the distinguished senior scientist in the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Trenberth has been a lead author in at least two reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's an acknowledged world expert on some of the issues raised in this paper by Hansen et al. While Dr. Trenberth decided not to do a live interview on this paper, he did send me his considered comments, and he agreed I could read them out to you on Radio EcoShock. Here is what Trenberth says about the paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. The new Hansen et al. Study is provocative and intriguing, but rife with speculation and what-if scenarios. It has many conjectures and huge extrapolations based on quite flimsy evidence, but evidence nonetheless. In that regard, it raises good questions and topics worthy of further exploration, but it is not a document that can be used for setting policy for anthropogenic climate change, although it pretends to be so. The paper is long. It hinges upon interpretation of paleo and other data that is apt to be somewhat controversial. It uses a model that is a coarse resolution and which does not have very good climate simulation. The evaluation model leaves much to be desired. No differences are shown compared with observations, and some errors are large. No mention is made of ENSO or Pacific Decadal Variations that dominate interannual and decadal variability in the real world, and which are a key to understanding the recent hiatus and recent trends that are not representative of longer-term trends, although frequently interpreted as such. In Section 3.8.5, the authors point out the need to simulate a number of features realistically, and the model does not really do them very well, especially basic things like sea surface salinity. So the relevance of the model is not established. They use the model for a number of highly artificial experiments that are supposed to depict melting of ice at high latitudes, fresh water injection. These experiments introduce a lot of very cold fresh water in various places, and then they see what happens. The question is how relevant these are to the real world, and what is happening as global warming progresses. They do not seem at all realistic to me. A key to a lot of this is how clouds change, and one needs to get clouds right in the first place to have confidence in the results. Unfortunately, this is an area where major problems exist. Huge problems occur over the southern oceans, for instance, and all models have far too much sunshine penetrating to the surface, compared with observations. No doubt the Southern Ocean, featured strongly by Hansen et al., plays an important role, but data, these are poor, and change is not well known. In particular, the recent hiatus in global warming greatly influences any observations, which can therefore be quite misleading when it comes to long-term trends. I certainly do not believe the result claimed with regard to less snow over Antarctica with a warming climate, although Hansen argues that the real world is responding even faster than in the model scenarios, this is not at all clear, owing to the natural variability. The paper is quite well written, and a tour de force in many respects, but there are way too many assumptions and extrapolations for anything here to be taken seriously other than to promote further studies. The authors often say that these model limitations must be kept in mind, and there are many other model limitations not discussed, but then they do not keep them in mind when drawing conclusions. Some of the conclusions with regard to the need for immediate actions I strongly agree with, but it seems that this study has gone out of its way to make the case, stretching credibility. Kevin Trenberth. Those were comments from Dr. Kevin Trenberth. He's the senior scientist at the Climate Analysis Section at the U.S. Government National Center for Atmospheric Research. So he certainly knows a lot about this subject. So what do I think? I'm not sure it matters, as I'm not a climate scientist, a politician, or an expert. Still, from the hundreds of scientists that I have interviewed over the past 10 years, and my research and watching climate events over the past 25 years, I will offer a few tentative things. First, as a science journalist, it seems to me we're always playing catch-up with reality. The science, particularly projections by the IPCC, always seem at least a decade behind what actually happens. Jim Hansen says the models are not sufficient. He presents one way he thinks they are broken. The group appears to say we need a new set of assumptions to get where the climate is really going. But they are assumptions, and that's dangerous for science. I have followed James Hansen's career since the early 1990s. He tends to ask extreme questions in order to test them. For example, he published a paper investigating whether Earth could lose its atmosphere due to runaway climate change, or are there natural breaks? Hansen found we won't lose the atmosphere, but he asked the question, likely due to his early work on the atmosphere of Venus and Mars is a planet which may have lost its atmosphere, so he is looking at extreme edges. I am least certain about the work on superstorms, a subject which seems to worry and fascinate James Hansen. His first book was Storms of My Grandchildren. He's working on a second. He may be right in the long run, but I have not seen a train of evidence to suggest off-the-charts monster storms will be seen this century, much less before 2050. Likewise, the projection that the North Atlantic ocean currents could be overturned this century due to ice melt runs against the scientific work I've seen so far on that subject, and I thought that was laid to rest, at least for the short term. I applaud the Hansen team promoting a more open platform for publishing, where other scientists and the interested public can see the questions and answers that shape the development of science. These topics are too important to wait a year or two in the dark in the previous publication process. On the other hand, I think review by one's peers, and in this case it would take the world's top scientists, remains essential to keep close to fact and truth. In my view, James Hansen and his group became frustrated with science that was unable to keep up with rapid climate change. They challenged the world to do better, and they challenged the political system to realize there are unacceptable risks to all this. This isn't a game. We probably won't know how right or wrong this paper is until 2030, if not 2050. By then, of course, we will be utterly committed to Earth with a very different climate. We just don't know how different or how fast we will get there. I invited Dr. Hansen to speak on this program. He agreed to a day and time last week, but then at the very last minute excused himself to attend another appointment. He has not responded to my requests to reschedule. I find this unprofessional, but I don't know the stress and the workload he bears. I'm sorry to miss his input. I'll get more reaction to this paper on ice melt, superstorms, and sea level rise as it comes in. Other scientists and activists have agreed to talk about this. I'll be putting a ton of links for you to follow up in my weekly show blog this week at ecoshock.info. Please check that out. You can find the original paper, the comments of the reviewers, essential news articles about it, and a lot more, and that's published Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Now we move to one of the biggest current impacts of climate change on this planet, and that's saying something. As I struggle to cover world problems, comes a call from Vivian Langford. She's the host of Beyond Zero on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. You must cover the mass bleaching of coral in the Great Barrier Reef, she said. And Vivian sent me a link to a powerful story by David Spratt. He's the author of the book Climate Code Red and one of my favorite blogs, which is also called Climate Code Red. And David asks, after the record, mind-numbing coral bleaching, what would it take to save the reef? Good question. David Spratt, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Lovely to be with you.
Okay, now as you write in your blog, back in 2009, Charlie Veron, one of the world's greatest coral experts, told the Royal Society the Great Barrier Reef was on a death watch, as he put it, and that was then. But let's back up a little bit, David. We've all seen video of gorgeous coral, but it's hard for us to grasp the size of Australia's giant reef. How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, this long before we had World Heritage listings, I mean, this was often listed as one of the seven great wonders of the natural world, together with Mount Everest, the Antarctic Victoria Falls, and so on. So this is a magnificent thing that stretches almost 3,000 kilometres down the east coast of Australia. This is something that you can see from outer space, literally, in its size. There's no other coral structure like it in the world. It's the most precious ecosystem we have in Australia.
Yes, and I know it's mind-boggling the amount of living things that depend on it, but could you talk to us a little bit about the biological importance of this Great Barrier Reef?
Well, look, barrier reefs have actually, coral structures have been around for 500 million years. I mean, they're really old. Corals have produced more fossils than anything else in this world. A quarter of all marine species live in and around coral systems. And around the world, particularly in Asia, but in other places as well, there are tens of millions of people who depend on coral reefs, and because they're very rich environments, particularly for people who use marine protein as their primary form of protein, they're absolutely essential for many people in the developing world for their day-to-day survival. So from so many perspectives, they are just so essential.
And could you explain what gives the coral those brilliant colours we've seen, and then why it can go white?
Coral, I guess to many of us, has two meanings. One is those big limestone structures we see. So the coral animal, the coral polyp, is like a small jellyfish, and it builds a base of limestone, of calcium carbonate, in which it situates itself and builds structures. So you've got an inert limestone base and an animal that lives on the top layer of it. That coral polyp lives in a symbiotic relationship with a very small algae called zooxanthella. And that algae and the coral polyp, the coral animal, are codependent because the algae produces the oxygen that the polyp needs and the polyp produces the carbon dioxide that the algae needs. So they have to go together. And it's the algae that actually give coral those many bright colours we see. If the temperature, the water temperature, gets too hot, the polyps get stressed and they expel the algae. And if they expel all the algae, and once they're expelled, they do not come back. So if you have what's called, and this is why we have the word bleaching, because if the coral polyp expel the algae, the coral loses its colour and goes that almost translucent white colour, so hence the notion of bleaching. So you can have bleaching which is not so severe, where some of the algae will be expelled or some of the corals in a reef system will expel their algae, but not all of them. In a severe bleaching, what we've seen this time, the corals literally die because they are starved of food and nutrients, and that's what we're seeing in an unprecedented way on the most pristine section of the Barrier Reef at the moment.
And how much of that Great Barrier Reef has bleached white this year?
Well, there are are about 3,000 reef systems in the Great Barrier Reef, stretching over 3,000 kilometres. Scientists over the last month, 6 weeks, have done a survey, both an aerial survey and getting into the water, where they spent a lot of time, and they assessed 910 reefs. And of them, they found 500 to be what they called severely bleached, which means that their prognosis is not good. In particular, the northernmost 1,000 kilometres of the reef, which stretches from northern Queensland through the Coral Sea up almost to New Guinea, is the most pristine, the most touched, the highest value section of the reef. In that section, the northern section, they found that more than 50% mortality of corals already. Now, it must be understood that when they go back in 2 or 3 months, that mortality rate will be up. They think it will be around 90% on some of the reefs. So we, and really, sadly, are looking at perhaps most, certainly most, three-quarters more even, of the best 1,000 kilometres of the Barrier Reef just having died from climate change, from record hot waters in the Coral Sea this Australian summer.
Yes, when masses of coral first turned white in the 1980s, people thought it was a disease. How do we know, David Spratt, that it's really a signal of climate change?
The fact is, there hadn't been a bleaching event until the 1980s, so this is a new phenomenon. And bleaching can be reproduced in the laboratory. I mean, a lot of work has been done on the Barrier Reef. It's an essential part of Australia's identity, of its natural ecosystems. It also supports 80,000 people in terms of the tourist industry. It's one of Australia's best-known icons. So a lot of work's been done. And you can, in a laboratory situation, take waters with corals in them and warm them up and watch this process happening. You can also increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the water, which is another consequence of climate change. As we put more into the air, about 40% of that carbon dioxide is drawn down into the water, mixes with H2O to produce carbonic acid, which is a weak acid, and that acid itself will eat away at limestone structures, whether they be corals or the shells of hard animals like crabs and so on. And they've produced this in the laboratory, so this is now a well-known and well-observed event.
And have the seas around Australia been hotter than normal?
Yes, we've just had particularly the section which is most badly bleached had the hottest waters on record, literally without exception, about 1 degree warmer than the average over the last 20 years. That is partly a consequence of the El Nino. As we know, in the El Nino, you get a very large blob of warm water in the eastern Pacific. As the El Nino starts to moderate, as is happening at the moment, the normal trade winds resume and that warm water gets moved westward. So 6 months ago, some of the coral scientists were saying, you know, we've got a bad feeling. We can see this really large warm mass of water, which we think is probably heading towards Australia, and that's what's happened.
So, as you said, coral's been around for about 500 million years. It has faced mass extinction events before, and somehow it recovered. David, why are marine scientists so worried about the bleaching this year?
Well, what we have to understand is that if a coral is killed by a bleaching event, that is, it loses all its algae, the limestone structure remains, but the polyps, the animals inside, die. And then the only way that that coral reef can be rebuilt is for new coral larva to settle on the old structure and start the building process again. So downstream from the existing reef, a new reef can be formed, and that's how coral spreads. Charlie Veron, who I quote in the article, I mean, literally the godfather of coral science, a man who has identified and named a third of the world's corals, told me that it takes about 15 years after a bleaching event for the coral, as he said it, to look good again, for a bleached reef to be recolonised with new coral. If, in a global warming world, you have these warmer seas more and more often, you're going to get bleaching events at shorter and shorter intervals, so you just don't get that 10 to 15 years for recovery. So it's really a death spiral of bleaching events at shorter and shorter intervals. And some scientists at the University of Melbourne, led by Professor David Caroli, just did some work around some models and said this event of warm waters we had this year, which was extraordinary, they said in 20 years' time, by 2034, we believe that these sort of water temperatures around the reef will happen once every 2 years. And that's a death sentence for coral reefs in terms of the incapacity to rebuild before they get whacked again. It's like sort of, you know, getting hit and standing up and getting hit again. It's just a terrible sequence of events. And so what we have come to understand now, that at global average warming is now about 1 degree around the world. At 1 degree, coral systems will not survive.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, David Spratt. He's the author of the book and blog Climate Code Red, and the latest climate emergency is for coral in Australia's Great Barrier Reef.
Sorry, I think we should also say that, of course, these bleaching events are not confined to Australia. They're happening right around the world in different places, depending on the particular sea temperatures. So my recent study has been at the Great Barrier Reef, but this is a story that can be told in many places, from the Middle East to the Caribbean and right through Asia.
Right. It is a global story, and I wish we had time to cover it, and I'm hoping to get there eventually. So getting back to Australia's case, though, is part of the Great Barrier Reef already dead?
Coral reefs have been under the hammer for a long time. So a study was done a few years ago, and they established that the extent, literally the footprint of the Great Barrier Reef, is about half of what it was 30 or 35 years ago. That is due to a number of factors. There was a large bleaching event in 1998 associated with the previous El Nino. Because we've had 15 years, most of the corals have come back. So about 10% of the loss of the barrier reef extent is due to bleaching. There are obviously a number of other problems that coral reefs have in Australia. We have a terrible thing called the crown of thorn starfish, which has literally been chewing it up. We also have a problem that the barrier reef is just off the Queensland coast, where there's a lot of agriculture, particularly sugarcane, and a lot of the fertilisers run off the land and into the ocean, and they also have a terrible effect by fertilising predators. We're also having more intense cyclones, and the commotion on the surface of the water can physically destroy reefs as well. So reefs are under the hammer from a number of sources, but this event of monumental destruction is directly a climate change-related one.
And what happens to a reef once the actual coral animals are gone?
Well, we've got three possibilities. If the reef is only partially bleached, that is, there are some algae remaining in the coral, then those corals will recover, and that happens. If all the algae is recovered, is expelled from a coral, two things can happen. With enough time, new larva can come and settle on it and rebuild it, but the coral structure can also become diseased, and it just starts to break up, and in the end you get what I would, in a very unscientific way, called a green slime that just builds over the coral, and over a period of years to decades, the limestone structure itself will just break down and look, you know, like the remnants of a collapsed building scattered across the floor of the ocean.
I've heard it described as rubble.
Rubble, indeed.
Well, so far, as you know, this year 2016 has broken global heat records, not by a little bit, but by a lot. And how close are we to the upper limits where coral can survive around Australia?
Well, we've now had, at 1 degree of global average warming, an extraordinary event where the sea surface temperatures were a degree hotter than normal. The last event, as I said, was the largest, biggest bleaching between 1998 and 2002, so we've had 10 years. The corals recovered. If we stayed at this 1 degree of global warming, I mean, it may be 5 years before another hot water event. It may be 15. I mean, the coral might struggle on to some extent at 1 degree of warming. But if we get another half a degree of warming, and there was a very important peer-reviewed piece of research done, which said that if you got the global average temperatures of 1.5 degrees, and that's what we're looking at in, you know, perhaps the next 20 years, another half degree of warming, then their estimate was that coral reefs would be reduced to less than 10% of their present area. They would be remnant systems. They wouldn't be something that we would call part of a Great Barrier Reef. It would be a tiny barrier reef. So another half degree of warming, which is sort of in the system now, and they'll be gone. If we stayed at the current temperature, they'd struggle on better and not so well.
Let's get to the human role. Since Australia counts on billions of dollars in tourist revenue and other kinds of revenue, as you talked about, from this famous reef system, I assume the government is focused on saving them, are they?
The barrier reef tourist operators are in a difficult position. As I mentioned before, there's about 80,000 people, $8 to $10 billion a year of economic activity generated off the reef. The tourist operators don't want to scare away the visitors, so they're saying that there are parts of the reef which you can still visit, which is true. They must also know that their long-term business plan is that they won't have a business. So they're caught in a contradiction. The Australian government has played a terrible role. We have an environment minister who keeps on saying he wants to save the reef and then gives planning permission, environmental permission for huge new coal mines to be opened. So objectively, the Australian government is aiding and abetting the destruction of the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, we're kind of like that in Canada. We talk about the environment and then we promote the tar sands. We've just had a big fire near the tar sands and the Canadian Prime Minister came out and said, well, we'll rebuild right away. I could go on and on, but I won't.
No. And I'm sure people who draw a connection between as we have in Australia, between extraordinary outer season or extreme bushfires and climate change, and they want to shoot the messenger for suggesting what is obviously and scientifically able to be demonstrated.
Yes, I put out a little YouTube about it and got some terrible comments, but that's just part of the game. Now, I have to think, though, that when I hear Australian politicians, both federal and state, promising to expand coal mining, coal ports, more coal exports, they must somehow think the Great Barrier Reef is expendable, a kind of collateral damage. What do you think is going on in their minds?
Look, that's a good question. I think that in Australia, which is the two important things about Australia, we have the highest greenhouse emissions per capita of any developed country in the world. So we are really profligate. We have really large fossil fuel export capacity, which is trying to be built. Unfortunately, the collapsing coal demand and coal prices has stopped, at least the time being, a whole lot of new coal mines being built, particularly inland from the Barrier Reef. But these are people who have seen fossil fuels as a cargo cult and cannot understand that the continued operation of the fossil fuel industry and having a planet that livable are simply contradictory propositions. And it has to be said that, in my experience and the experience of others, most of these politicians and their advisors are very poorly informed on the science. Maybe that's deliberate, but in a basic, scientific, emotional, existential way, they simply don't get it.
But I know that there are millions of Australians who are deeply concerned about the Great Barrier Reef as it fights for its life. Who are the voices in the groups struggling to save the Great Reef?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question about whether and how the Great Barrier Reef could be saved now. I mean, the simple proposition is that at 1 degree of global warming, the reef's in severe trouble. With more warming, it's certainly going to be in a death spiral. So to say something like the Barrier Reef actually means having a conversation and trying to think about whether we can stop physical global warming getting any worse than it is now, because if it is, the reef will be gone. If we can hold global warming at 1 degree and knock it down a bit by large amounts of carbon drawdown and so on, then maybe it's got a hope. That's a very difficult conversation, I think, for a lot of climate groups and activists to have. Certainly, over the last 3 or 4 years in Australia, a lot of work has been done to draw the connections between the proposals for new coal mines on the Queensland coast near the Barrier Reef and the future of the reef. But in fact, the reef is being killed not by future coal mines, but by the coal mines and the oil that's been extracted over the last 20 or 30 years. So lots of campaigning and honestly, a lot of deep heartfelt concern and pain about what people have seen.
I'm feeling it myself. Have you seen some action in the international arena about pressuring Australia or trying to help Australia to save this reef?
Well, yes. Some of my friends in North America have pointed out to me that there are climate campaigning organisations in the United States and Canada who've actually been directing their members to get into contact with their politicians and also Australian politicians in Australia. So I think there's been quite a bit of solidarity in terms of this issue, as indeed there needs to be.
And if we lose this battle, and we may, how fast might it go dark and dead?
Well, I think it's a death spiral. I mean, the bleaching wasn't even, it was worse on the north than the south. A lot of the southern areas are not in such bad shape, so they will battle on. Maybe the next surge of hot water will hit a different part of the reef, so there won't be a moment when the lights will go out. But just the extent, the footprint of the reef, its connectedness will suffer. So it will be death by a thousand small warmings, I'm afraid. Certainly in coral scientists really honestly say, they've said, if you want a safe reef, bleaching started at around 320 to 340 parts per million of carbon dioxide. I mean, that was 30, 40 years in the past. We're now at 400 parts per million. When we got to 387 parts per million almost 10 years ago, they said, we're now past the point where the reef can survive. So that's some context that it is now our past emissions and sins, which are dreadfully catching up with us.
Right, and there's about a 30-year delay, I've heard.
That's right.
From what we already burned is still to come.
That's right. I mean, we saw another example of that a couple of years ago when that really important research came out on some of the West Antarctic glaciers, and they said, we can now see that some of these glaciers have passed their tipping points for total loss of the glacier, of increasing glaciation, and that will lead to 1 or 2 metres off the immediate glaciers, but this will trigger glaciation of much more of West Antarctic, which is 3 to 5 metres of sea level rise. And we asked some of the scientists who'd been involved in that work, so when do you think the tipping point was, and at what level of carbon dioxide do you think this event happened? And they said, look, you've got to go back to the 1970s. You'd have to go back to 1970s levels of carbon dioxide probably to stop those West Antarctic ice sheets tipping over. So as with the Barrier Reef and so many other things, we don't see these tipping points coming because by their nature, in a way, we can't. But when they do occur, what we're seeing is things that were put in train decades before, and that's the whole story of global warming and its delayed consequences.
We almost see it in the rearview mirror.
Yes, unfortunately, unless we can turn the car or the truck or the bus or the tram around very quickly.
So you published Climate Code Red in 2008. Are you considering a new edition of the book, another book, or is that your blog?
That's my blog now. I think things are changing so quickly that when we wrote that book, somebody said we were pretty adventurous. Some people would have called us alarmist back then. But in fact, that book has stood the test of time better than most, in that most of the things it talked about, we talked in that book back in 2007 and 2008, of the West Antarctic ice sheet probably having past its tipping point when very few other people did. So it's still relevant in a way, but I think the pace of change is now so great that you're always playing catch-up, as indeed some of the climate science is. I mean, the noticeable thing about the last year and the El Nino and the extraordinary events that have happened in Alberta, in the Great Barrier Reef, the extraordinary droughts in Asia, in the water shortages in India, the food problems in southern Africa, is that the observations, what's actually happening on the ground, often seem in advance of what we thought or projected would happen. And that's been the story of global warming over the last 20 years. I remember when we did our book and there'd been that incredible ice mass loss, sea ice mass loss in the northern summer of 2007 in the Arctic. And one of the climate scientists said, but this is happening 100 years ahead of schedule. And in fact, the laws of physics don't wait for our schedules. They proceed as they must. And this is one of the problems, that the risks associated with climate change and what will happen, I think, are often been underestimated in the public conversation, unless you really take a lot of time and effort, as you have in your program, and we've talked about this before, to really get to grips with all the risks and all the possibilities. And public policymakers have tended to veer to the other side of the road and in a way try to downplay the risk, I think.
From Melbourne, Australia, we've been talking with David Spratt. He's the author, blogger, and activist, and chronicler of the age of climate change, I think. You can find links for this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. You can follow David Spratt at climatecodered.org, and on Twitter his handle is at DJ Spratt. David, thank you for all your work for the climate and for talking with us today.
It's a great pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.